morning. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're with us for the morning show as we talk about prescription drug prices. Governor Evers this week announced 21 appointments to his task force on reducing prescription drug prices. And this comes out of his executive order in August. The group is charged with making recommendations to bring down drug costs in our state. So this task force, they won't meet until next month, but conversation starts right here. Do you forego certain meds because you can't afford them? What kind of tough decisions have you faced? What do you think this task force should know about your situation? We're at 800-642-1234. Ian Hedges is on the task force. He's CEO of the nonprofit HealthNet of Rock County. That's a free clinic providing medical services to uninsured people. And Rock County includes Janesville and Beloit. Ian, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate, for having me today.
So HealthNet offers reduced price services to people who can't otherwise go to the doctor and afford the doctor. But what happens when someone without insurance needs a prescription filled?
We actually are a medication repository, which means that individuals can donate medications to us and then they can be reused for our patients. So we have a medication room attached to our medical clinic. Last year, that medication room actually provided $1.5 million worth of prescription medications for free to low-income uninsured individuals in Rock County.
Wow. So you definitely see a need for that repository.
Correct. And it does not seem like that need is going away anytime soon, not only with the rise of prescription drug prices, but also the increased amount of individuals who are working in the labor force and possibly losing Badger Care and then having no means for insurance. And so, you know, we've seen that the uninsured rate has grown a little bit steadily over the last several years.
For people who can't be without their medications and have to pay out of pocket, how have you seen that affect their lives when they start coming to you at the repository?
I mean, it's somewhat dramatic because individuals will have to forego certain items in their life in order to stay alive. One of the biggest examples that I can tell you about is insulin. We provide insulin for free to individuals who otherwise could not afford it. However, we run short of insulin supply quite frequently, and a box on wholesale for us for insulin is usually around $400 to $500. It has about 5 pens. We have some patients that each month require 16 pens. Now, that's the most dramatic kind of situation, but that's at a wholesale price of more than $1,500 for an individual just to maintain their condition. If they are not able to maintain their condition, it only gets worse, but it affects their prospects for an employment and even in some cases housing.
Wow. Ian Hedges is with us. He heads up the nonprofit HealthNet of Rock County. That's a free clinic that provides medical services to uninsured. And he's been appointed to serve on Governor Evers' new task force on reducing prescription drug prices. Ian, how do you plan to apply your experience serving people who are below the poverty line to people who aren't? What universal issues do you plan to bring to the task force?
Well, just like every individual who is even on the insurance market, our patients are still consumers within the market, even though they're coming to us for charity care. So I think that our organization hopes to represent them as consumers, and they have unique understandings or unique issues as consumers that probably need to be brought up to the task force in order to ensure that they are able to afford their medications in the future. I think also the scope of how problematic the issue is dramatically undernoticed. I can assure you that last week when I was walking through our clinic, just over a two-hour period, we served 30 patients and individuals. And during that time, we were able to give their pharmaceuticals to them, and we dispensed more than $10,000 just within that two-hour period worth of pharmaceuticals because the need is so great.
Well, getting back to insulin, and when you look at price transparency and what you pay for medications outright, what do you want to see come through price transparency with prescription drugs?
Well, many states, including California, Florida, and Minnesota, have explored the possibility of price transparency within pharmaceuticals because, as you know, with most products out in the market, it's between you and the seller. But with pharmaceuticals, it's between you and five other individuals, whether that be your insurance, a healthcare agency that you're receiving it from, the pharmacy benefit manager, and the wholesaler and the manufacturer. So clearly, it's a very complex issue that basically ensures that the process doesn't operate like all other products on the open market. So I think that it is a worthy discussion for us to have, especially as many other states have had that discussion because of certain limits that we have in which we can't regulate pharmaceuticals due to that being mostly regulated by federal law.
Do you think the patients who come to HealthNet know what would happen if your resources weren't there for their prescription medications? Because you can fill out forms and apply directly, I understand, to the prescription provider, the maker of the drug. Are there other options for these people?
Well, I can tell you that HealthNet actually is heavily involved with those prescription assistance program applications. Last year, we actually had more than three volunteers assisting our patients applying for those medications, and we were able to receive $800,000 worth of those medications directly from the pharmaceutical companies to our patients. However, those forms are pages long. They're certainly above a eighth grade reading level. They're actually probably meant for someone who is in college or with a university degree. And it's also requires many steps and attachments just to receive the initial approval process. And you have to go through that approval process on an annual basis. So I think that pharmaceutical companies are trying to assist in best ways they can, and they're trying to ensure that the patients who are getting the drugs are the individuals who actually need it. But it still requires a lot of paperwork, which remains somewhat of a barrier to our patients. And so I think what they would have to utilize, unfortunately, are those prescriptions savings cards, but not all generics that are covered under those prescription saving cards are always widely available. And so sometimes you do have to pay that higher price tag for a name brand pharmaceutical.
So the task force first meeting happens on November 20th. There isn't an agenda that's been posted yet publicly, but what would you like to see come out of the task force and some of the first issues you put on the table?
The wonderful thing about this task force that I'm actually very excited for is that it is a bipartisan task force. And also, I think it's an issue, too, that has a lot of momentum coming from both sides of the aisle. How rare is it that President Donald Trump and Senator Tammy Baldwin actually agree on an issue? And this is the issue that they agree needs to have more solutions to in order for consumers to have readily access to medications. So I think what we're really excited for is that all stakeholders, that not only includes agencies like myself and the state agencies, but pharmaceutical companies, healthcare systems are going to be actively involved in that conversation and hopefully coming up with solutions in which there will be fewer barriers for individuals.
Ian, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Kate.
Ian Hedges, a CEO of the free clinic HealthNet of Rock County. He will serve on the governor's new task force on reducing prescription drug prices. Coming up, tis the season for the FAFSA. We look at how Wisconsin families are filling out this form for federal student financial aid. Back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, it is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're talking about a form called the FAFSA that helps families pay for a college education. FAFSA stands for Free Application for Federal Student Aid. If you're planning to attend college next year, either as a new student or a returning student, you should apply for federal financial aid right now. The U.S. Department of Education started accepting applications this month for next year, so it's open season for the FAFSA, if you will. Have you completed the FAFSA for yourself or a family member? What did you think of the process? Where have you stumbled along the way? We're at 800-642-1234. Ellie Brooker is a PhD student at UW-Madison who studies financial aid applications and other higher ed issues. Ellie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
So this month is kind of like Christmas for higher education researchers like yourself because you get all this federal government data, a big dump of it on financial aid. What have you learned so far from digging through this new data on FAFSA?
Yeah, so we get every Friday new information by school for the entire country on how many 12th graders have completed a FAFSA. So we're about 3 weeks of data into the new cycle. And so far, nationally, we have about 13% of our 12th graders have completed a FAFSA already. Generally, that number gets up to about 62% by the end of the year. In the case of Wisconsin, those numbers are both a bit lower. So that's what we're seeing right out of the gate so far for Wisconsin. About 7,800 12th graders have completed a FAFSA. That's about 11% of our 12th graders.
How does that compare to past cycles or past Octobers?
Yeah, pretty similar. Okay. It looks like we're about on track to be about a 55% filing rate, as same as last year.
There's been a recent push by colleges in Wisconsin, some nonprofits as well, to help some families complete the FAFSA, do it sooner. Does that push seem to be working?
It does. So we see that events like College Goal Sunday that are sitting at certain high schools, that those high schools will have increased filing rates in those weeks. We also see that certain programs like texting nudges, so reminding students to fill out the FAFSA. We just had some new research released on that shows that increases both FAFSA filing and eventual college enrollment.
So when those financial aid officers are sending text messages to those students who are doing a gazillion things on their phone, capturing them in the moment on their phone could prove to be helpful in getting them that form in.
Yes. And as of last year, you actually can fill out the FAFSA on your phone. There's a mobile app to complete the FAFSA.
So when you look at other states, how does Wisconsin compare with other states in terms of FAFSA completion rates?
Not so great. Wisconsin's consistently been in the bottom 15 states for about the last three cycles. So while the national filing rates generally get up to 62%, some states as high as 78%, Wisconsin generally sits a bit below average at about 55%.
What's going on there? Why do you think that is?
Well, in Wisconsin in particular, and nationally we see these trends as well, but they do appear stronger in Wisconsin, that income and FAFSA completion are directly related. So our schools serving more lower-income students tend to have much lower filing rates in our state than the wealthier schools. So that, I think, has something to do with it. Wisconsin also has a lot of rural, remote areas where students don't live near a college. And we tend to see lower FAFSA filing rates in those school districts where students aren't within, 30 miles of a post-secondary institution.
What about access to a computer and to the technology and the internet to file this form?
I would guess that has a lot to do with it. Again, I think that's what the federal government was trying to, get at with having a mobile app. But we don't really have any good data on how internet access affects FAFSA filing.
We're talking about the free application for federal student aid. It's commonly known as the FAFSA. And UW researcher Ellie Brooker is helping us look at new data. And later, two financial aid advisors will join us to field your questions on completing the form. Call anytime this hour, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Let's dig into that a little bit more. You found that Wisconsin schools with more low-income families and more racial minorities tend to complete the FAFSA less often. What could be going on there? What's causing that? Because at the same time, you have a lot of workshops going on in communities.
Right. So I think it's kind of there's a lot of issues happening here. I think in particular, you have just less college going in lower income schools. So there are fewer students who intend to go to college. But we also see that those schools who serve lower income students have fewer resources to go around. So they might have higher student to counselor ratios. So you have high school counselors who are overwhelmed with more students to help in terms of the college access process, whereas more well-resourced schools are going to have a lower number of students per counselor to help them fill out the FAFSA.
And so there's a lot more handholding if you're
right.
able to have more of that one-on-one time. And it sounds like the FAFSA is not a form you want to go at alone.
No, it is not. It's a really complicated form. And we're seeing efforts at the federal government level to simplify that form. But so far, you know, those have still been kind of hung up in reauthorizing the Higher Education Act.
There's been also some movement to connect the form to your IRS tax data and a retriever tool.
Yeah, the IRS data retriever tool allows you to, in many cases, to fill in most of the information that you would need to go and look at your tax, your parents' tax reform or tax return and fill in that information. This tool allows you to just kind of fill most of that information in. But for our especially low-income students from families whose parents don't file taxes, that's not going to help. So we ask a lot of our very low-income students in terms of like proving that they have financial need.
Mm. So, and also, too, it gets really complicated when you have blended families and the
yes.
whole aspect of who are the parents here, who, you know, where who's in charge of the dependent, and that can get tricky with the FAFSA.
Definitely.
So how might schools and policymakers or lawmakers address these issues to improve FAFSA completion rates? What would you recommend?
So the data that I download every Friday in cleanup is actually available. You could get that data from states to the school districts and school counselors. So there are some states like Tennessee who have set up the data infrastructure that school counselors have access to that data. They can log in to their school district websites and see how many students filled out a FAFSA in the last week and keep better track of that information. If we don't have the data structure like that, like Wisconsin does not have that data structure, it's a lot of work for a school counselor who is probably already incredibly busy to download this data and clean it up. And there's a certain level of a capacity issue there. So I think Wisconsin really needs to think about how to invest in creating that data structure. But I think in the meantime, what I've done and what our research lab, the STAR Lab at UW-Madison has done is to create a map that's updated live. So Wisconsin high school counselors could use that resource to check the number of students completing FAFSAs per week. But again, it could be a lot easier if the state were to set up the data infrastructure.
Some states like Louisiana, they require high school grads to complete the FAFSA. And if you don't, you have to fill out a waiver.
Yes.
What do you make of that type of program?
Yeah, so it's still very new to see what the effects of mandatory FAFSA are. I think what we've seen so far is that in Louisiana, that bumped up their FAFSA filing rates to almost 78%. So almost all of their 12th graders filling out a FAFSA. Their college enrollment didn't move as much. And I think my main concern with the newest states to add onto this, Illinois and Texas are both going to be implementing mandatory FAFSA. My worry with Texas is how this affects undocumented students who might not want to fill out a federal form like that, but who also would be less inclined to fill out a waiver explaining why. So we still have a lot to learn about the possible unintended consequences of mandatory FAFSA, but on the whole, it's probably a good thing for students to know what their financial aid offer could be.
What do you hope to learn from studying federal data week after week, month after month, and cleaning this up, you know, on financial aid applications?
Yeah. So really what we want to learn is how to get more students not only to fill out the FAFSA, but to receive the information on their financial aid package and go to college. So it doesn't matter if we get 75% of students in Louisiana to fill out a FAFSA if no more of them attend college. We have to also invest in helping students understand their financial aid offers, in understanding what's a loan versus a grant. And we need to, I think, really think about how that affects state financial aid. So state financial aid is first come, first serve, and it's finite. So when it's gone, it's gone. And if you fill out a FAFSA late in the season, then you may not get aid that you actually are eligible for. So one thing we can learn with this FAFSA filing data is when that starts to happen. So how late are these students filing that end up missing out on state financial aid that they really should be receiving?
Right, because what the experts, like you say, is you get this form in, the sooner the better,
yes.
and that way you have more access to the funding that is available out there.
Exactly.
Have we seen the needle move at all on the amount of federal aid that is available? It's like more than $150 billion at this point?
Yeah. Federal aid has not moved much at all. The Pell Grants the Pell Grant is our main form of grant aid for low-income students at the federal level, and we haven't seen that move very much. Its buying power is significantly smaller than it was, you know, say 10 years ago. So we really need to think carefully about what the actual aid amount is while we're also thinking about how to get more students to apply for it.
Ellie, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Ellie Brooker is a PhD student at UW-Madison who studies financial aid applications and other higher ed issues. Coming up, two college administrators take your questions on completing financial aid applications. Are you trying to complete the FAFSA for yourself or a family member? Where are you feeling confused or stuck? What do you want to know? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll get to your questions right after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. You're with us in the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and a new episode of Derailed dropped today. This is the Wisconsin Public Radio podcast where we wend our way through how high-speed rail almost came to Wisconsin. And this episode takes us to California and connects our state to what's happening with high-speed rail and going in between San Francisco and L.A. You can find Derailed wherever you get your podcasts or at WPR.org. Right now, we're talking about the FAFSA. This is the form that helps families pay for college, and the U.S. Department of Education started accepting applications this month for next school year. College-bound students are applying for a piece of the more than $150 billion of federal aid that is dispensed through grants and loans and work study. Have you found enough resources to help you complete the FAFSA? Has your high school or local college been helpful? Have you attended a workshop? What did you learn? How important is federal financial aid to your family? We're at 800-642-1234. Ashley Hansen is Associate Vice President of Admissions at Carthage College in Kenosha. Ashley, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for having me.
And we have Donna Dalvang. Did I pronounce that right, Donna?
You did.
All right. She is Director of Financial Aid at UW-Superior. Donna, welcome to you.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Donna, let's start with you. Should every student applying for college complete the FAFSA, even those students from middle-income or high-income households?
We always recommend it for a couple of reasons. One is that if a student has never filed before it, until they do it at least the first time, they really don't know what kind of situation they're in and what they might qualify for. The other thing is sometimes there are changes to income or life circumstances that get in the road throughout the academic year, and a student can, well, we call it a reevaluation, but a student can talk to their local financial aid office and maybe some adjustments can be made, but we can't do that if we don't have a base FAFSA on file.
Donna, if a student wants to enter college after their high school graduation, there is a timeline for completing the FAFSA. And Brian in Milwaukee called in, couldn't stay with us, but was wondering what the changes to the deadlines mean for the FAFSA. What's going on there with the deadlines?
Well, there really hasn't been a change to the deadline. The end of the academic year, June 30th, is the last date that a student can file a FAFSA for the current academic year. What has changed is a few years ago, it opened up sooner.
Uh-huh.
So it used to be available starting January 1 using the prior year income taxes, and that was difficult for families because most people don't have their income taxes filed on January 1. So it was backed up to October 1, and using prior year income taxes so that students had a little more leeway and a financial aid package available earlier to them to help them make a decision for the upcoming academic year.
Ashley, what kind of financial assistance can students become eligible to receive after completing the FAFSA?
Well, at Carthage, more than 90% of our students who apply for financial aid receive financial aid. And we break it down into three different sections where students may qualify for a merit-based scholarship, which is awarded at the time of acceptance based on their GPA and test scores. We offer competitive scholarships, which range from full tuition down to $20,000 per year. And then most importantly is filing that FAFSA form, because no matter if a family makes $50,000 or $200,000, there's always additional scholarship and grant money for the students, you know, which is money that they do not pay back and is typically renewable for their 4 years.
Yeah, as you look at the financial aid mix of your students at Carthage, how important is the FAFSA and what the contribution is on those federal opportunities?
It is very important. And, you know, as families and students are looking and completing their college search, financing is typically one of the number one factors and also can be one of the number one stressors in the search process. So it is very important that they are filing that form, and so that each school we can determine what scholarship and grant money that they may receive, and especially at that federal level when you were looking at the Wisconsin state grants that are available and even the federal money that they may qualify for as well.
We're talking with two college officials. Join us to answer your questions about the FAFSA, the Free Application for Federal Student Aid. Donna Dalving is from UW-Superior. Ashley Hansen is with Carthage College. Are you working on the FAFSA for yourself or a family member? What do you want to know? What are you struggling or feel puzzled about? Join in 800-642-1234. Let's go to Sarah in Menominee. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. I have a quick question in regards to declaring your savings account balance. So, you know, on the form it says, okay, what is the total of your savings account, investments, and so on. Let's say you have, $20,000 in your savings account, but you're setting aside $5,000 for estimated tax payments coming up and another $5,000 for, I don't know, home projects and so on. So really, if your balance is $10,000 that you have saved, what do you declare on the form? Do you write the total $20,000, or do you write $10,000, which is what you will have saved up, really, other than expenses?
Right. When that balance is fluctuating based on, you know, what it will be used for. Donna, could you field that?
Sure. The FAFSA instructions actually indicate that the FAFSA is a picture in time. So it's on the date you file your FAFSA, what do you have available to you? So you would need to include the total amount. Keep in mind that the FAFSA calculates a student and family's estimated financial contribution number with a great big complicated formula. And part of that is assets. Part of it is income. Part of it is household size. The asset piece, a portion of the assets are not looked at based on the age of the older parent is part of the formula. So a fluctuation in a few thousand dollars probably won't have much of an impact on the actual outcome. But the instructions for the FAFSA do indicate it's a picture in time and it's on the date you file the FAFSA, and that particular field you cannot update.
Ashley, what documents do FAFSA filers need to have with them, as whether they file it at home or they're in a group setting? What do you need on hand?
When parents and students are sitting down to file the FAFSA form, they can feel a little bit anxious because the form can be overwhelming. But the process has gotten relatively simpler over the past few years. And so as the parents and students are sitting down, which I do recommend that they sit down and do it together, they will need to set up first their FSA ID. That is how both one parent and one student will be able to electronically sign their FAFSA form, which is required in order for it to be processed. You know, we recommend that you go ahead and do that first, as sometimes it can take between 24 to 36 hours for that to process. But then you simply just need your information from the 2018 year or 2019, depending on what you are filing. And so there is an IRS data retrieval tool, which has made the process easier so that that information can electronically flow back and forth.
Oh, you're not digging up, tax documents from 2018.
Correct. You can do it that way. They will tell you line for line what everything what you need to pull over. But that IRS data retrieval tool is a really nice asset for these families to make that process simpler. You know, we always recommend, set aside 45 minutes to an hour. You know, here at Carthage, we walk families through filing the FAFSA form numerous times throughout the year because as a first-time college parent or student, it can seem a little bit overwhelming, but it's really just a matter of just taking that information and taking it line by line.
Let's go to Matt now in Johnson Creek with a question. Hi, Matt.
Hello. My question is about people with military service or parents that were in the military. Is a bonus or access to tuition grants or student loan repayment, is that kind of held against the person if they were to apply for FAFSA, or can they double dip? Or what kind of impacts does that have? I'll take Mance off the air.
Matt, thanks so much for the call. Donna, could you field that?
Yeah, I don't have a lot of information about that because I don't work with that. We have a veterans benefit coordinator in our area specifically. Ashley, do you have more information about that?
Typically, we work with, and most schools will work one-on-one with the family. It really comes down to an individual basis in terms of benefits. Usually, the student and the family will start with your local VA office, the benefits office, and let us know what you qualify for. You know, many schools may also have matching VA benefits available, whether it be the yellow ribbon and such. But really, it comes down to a case-by-case basis with these type of things to make sure that we have, all of the schools have the coverage that you need in honoring those benefits that you are eligible for.
It is FAFSA time. The U.S. Department of Education started accepting FAFSA forms this month for next school year. We have a pair of Wisconsin College administrators as our guides. Donna Dalving is from UW-Superior, and Ashley Hansen is from Carthage College in Kenosha. What do you want to know about applying for financial assistance from government or university programs? What kind of financial assistance have you been able to receive after completing the FAFSA? How did it help you? Join in with your story, your questions, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a moment, more conversation here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and it is open season for the FAFSA. We're talking about this form families fill out to help pay for a college education. And if you're applying now to attend college in fall 2020, you can file a FAFSA using your 2018 tax return. We've been talking about how it's linked up with the IRS data retrieval tool. It pulls in the most recent tax information without you entering it manually. So what questions do you have about the free application for federal student aid, the FAFSA? We're at 800-642-1234. We have college administrators Donna Dalving from UW-Superior and Ashley Hansen from Carthage College. They stay with us. Let's go back to the phones now. Andy is joining us from Dubuque. Hi, Andy.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Hey, I've been filling out the FAFSA for maybe 8 years already, and I got a few more years to go. And now I'm hearing that when you fill out the FAFSA or the promissory note, whichever it is, maybe both, you actually should be doing it in you do it in one parent's name, not both of them. And you should be doing it in the name of the lower wage earner. Is that true? Do you have information on that? Is that a question that's appropriate for you guys?
Ashley, can I field that one to you?
Absolutely. So when filing that, if the parents are married, you would file the information as a household. So you would be including both parents' information, wages, savings, assets, etc. And so, but you only electronically sign it with one parent's signature. Now, in the case of a split household, divorce, those type of things, you typically then would file with only one parent's information in that regard. So it all depends on whether or not the parent is married in that regard, but absolutely you would include both information but one parent's signature.
And blended families can start to get really tricky on this form. Is that right?
Absolutely. Yes. Well, with blended families, which is very common, and again, we are working individually with each student. And so with a blended family, if that parent of the child is remarried, that step-parent's income is considered with that financial information. You know, many times families will say, well, they are not the legal or birth parent to that person, but that doesn't matter. If the parents are married, that information is considered when filing the form.
Donna, anything else there you want to add?
Yeah, a little bit. If the parents are divorced or separated or were never married, then the student actually provides information for the biological or adoptive parent that they lived with most in the 12 months prior to filing the FAFSA, and that parent's current spouse if they have one. So that's how blended families, as you call it, would look at the FAFSA. If two biological parents are not married but living together as a family unit, then they would include both biological or adoptive parents' information. And all of this is regardless of gender.
Let's go to Andrea now in Sparta with a question. Hi, Andrea.
Hi. I help with a pre-college program for low-income single parents in La Crosse. And often the FAFSA form doesn't seem to fully kind of embrace the reality of a student parent applying for in the FAFSA. So I'd like to ask about what it's like, if there are some special considerations for students who have dependents. And then also, is there a point where you can make a modification if you have had some kind of change in, for instance, housing or some unexpected costs related to transportation and all. Just kind of understanding the cost of attendance with the student parents in mind. Could you speak to that, please?
Yeah, Andrea, great questions. Ashley, I'll start with you on students with dependents.
Yeah. So majority of schools will have, outside of the FAFSA form, their own paperwork for these type of unique situations, you know, whether it be a special circumstance form or appeal form, because as Donna said earlier, the FAFSA is simply just taking a snapshot in time in regards. And there's a lot of other factors that go into a family's financial information. So if there's a change in any information with a student, housing changes, their family unit changes, all of that, the families and students need to make sure that they are working individually with the offices that or with the schools that they are applying to. You know, with a student who may have their own dependent children, there may be ways that they can file that FAFSA form independently on their own. There are regulations set in place in which certain factors do take out that parent information if the student themselves have their own independent children as well.
Donna, it sounds like even a form with over 100 questions that you can't really truly crack every single situation, financial situation in our country to come on this form.
That's true. And there are a lot of questions on the FAFSA. But as indicated, you know, initially it goes through the dependency questions. So if a student is deemed independent and there's I don't know, a dozen or so questions that make that determination, then the student is providing information only about themselves, their household, which would be their dependent children, and their spouse if they have one. So, of course, that eliminates some income because their parents' information is not on the FAFSA.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it is a snapshot in time. People's lives change. For the 2021 FAFSA, we're using the 2018 tax information, and that's great if nothing much has changed for the income earners on the FAFSA. But when there has been a change, as Ashley indicated, our school as well, we can use professional judgment to make determinations at the local level and adjust a student's financial aid accordingly for the current financial flow of that family.
Mm-hmm.
One other thing the caller mentioned was, if a student had additional transportation costs or something like that, we can also make adjustments to the cost of attendance at our institution. So, for example, one line item on a cost of attendance is transportation. But if we have a commuter student that is traveling much further than our cost of attendance allows for transportation, they can let us know and we'll make it a budget adjustment for them.
Well, let's squeeze in one more call here. David in Sparta. David, hi.
Hi.
Really quickly.
So, okay. I just had a comment about the veterans benefits interaction with FAFSA. So they are completely separate. So Wisconsin actually has the Wisconsin GI Bill specific to Wisconsin schools. And the federal benefits don't affect your budget for school and also don't affect your FAFSA benefits.
Great clarification there. Yeah. David, thank you. Thank you so much for that. And Donna, how could you see the FAFSA getting easier, perhaps getting less complex? Because there is movement to do that.
There is. There's been a lot of conversation at a federal level about FAFSA simplification. And while in spirit, I am in much agreement with that, it is really hard to capture a student and family's financial situation truly. And we have an obligation as taxpayers to uphold the integrity of the Pell Grant program. So I find that very, very difficult in my mind to weigh out. I do believe the FAFSA form can be quite an access barrier for especially certain students and families who don't have a lot of support. I think it would be fantastic if that could be simplified and still capture the true financial strength of a family.
Donna, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And Ashley, thank you as well. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Kate.
Donna Delving is Director of Financial Aid at UW-Superior. Ashley Hansen is the Associate Vice President of Admissions at Carthage College in Kenosha. Just ahead, democratic socialism is more prominent in our politics today than it's been in a long time. We learn about spiritual socialism. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.